If I had to guess, I would bet I say the name Jay Powell more than that of any other person in this economy, today being just the most recent example. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today, the 10th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Cast your mind back with me now, gang, to the long-ago days of, well, the long-ago days of last month. March the 20th, a Wednesday, if you're curious, and one, the aforementioned Jerome Powell, chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System.
Given the overall favorable conditions in our economy, my colleagues and I will be patient in assessing what, if any, changes in the stance of policy may be needed.
That sentence in a post-interest rate setting meeting press conference and that word patient was widely interpreted at the time, here and elsewhere, to mean that the Fed was going to take its sweet old time when next it thought about raising interest rates. We told you that so we could tell you this. The Fed released its minutes of that March 19th and 20th meeting today, and down there, on page 11, second column, if you want to check, was this, quote, "A couple of participants noted that the patient characterization should not be seen as limiting the committee's options for making policy adjustments when they are deemed appropriate." Translation into English, the Fed is going to Fed no matter what everybody else thinks about this. All right, moving on. Elsewhere in the macroeconomic domain, news of inflation today, there is still practically none. The Consumer Price Index came out this morning. Core inflation, as it's known, that takes out food and energy, up just a 0.1% over a month ago. But you dig down, as one must with this kind of data, and you notice some components of the CPI moved quite a bit. Gas was up 6.5%. Apparel fell almost 2%, the biggest one-month drop there in 70 years. Point being, those kinds of month-to-month fluctuations show just how hard it is to measure inflation accurately and the speed at which this economy changes isn't helping at all. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman takes us out shopping to explain.
I went to my local grocery store to check prices, just like the 400 data gatherers the Bureau of Labor Statistics sends out every month.
So I love blueberries.
They have a big container of them from Mexico, and that's $7.99. A smaller container, $5.99, and those are organic, and they're from the U.S. So how do I compare those?
You want to be measuring what's actually coming out of the consumer's pocket.
Steve Reed is the economist in charge of consumer prices at BLS. He says it's crucial to compare like to like.
If you priced a different set of items, you wouldn't reliably be tracking how much the cost of living is changing.
That's fine if you're talking about T-shirts, which don't change much. But what about computers? Prices keep falling, but their power keeps rising. Former BLS Commissioner Erica Groshen says there are elaborate methods to capture that.
So when a new model comes in with a new bell and whistle, they can look at what's the average price difference for having this new feature.
BLS is always trying to improve its data. This month, it started using electronic transaction records from a national retailer. That may have impacted the inflation rate for apparel. Government's been trying to figure this out for a long time. Notre Dame historian Thomas Stapleford says if you had been a Revolutionary War soldier, you'd have cared when Massachusetts
agreed to start adjusting the pay rates for their militia based on the prices of beef and Indian corn and sheep's wool.
Prices were skyrocketing. Getting soldiers to re-enlist depended on getting that inflation rate right, just like it does today for cost of living adjustments. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, so this next item is going to roll those Fed minutes I was talking about and low interest rates and Mitchell's story about inflation and prices into one big giant ball of, oh, so this is why it matters to me. 10 years on from the financial crisis, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates just 9 times, and rates are, by historical standards, still really low. And yes, there are plenty of upsides to cheap money, of course, more borrowing, more spending, more investment, ultimately more growth. But there are also costs to having interest rates so low, so long. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains that one.
To quote one of the creepiest lines of The Handmaid's Tale, ordinary is just what you're used to. And so for those of you who are used to the past 10 years of bank accounts returning almost nothing on interest and treasury rates being 2 to 3%, this was not always ordinary.
I mean, if I could go back to the 80s and get some of those interest rates for my clients, it would be amazing.
Marianne Ferreira is a certified financial planner at Viridian. 10-year treasury yields were almost 16% at one point in the early 80s. You could get amazing returns if you were saving money. Since the financial crisis, in particular, rates have been extremely low, close to zero at one point.
If the financial crisis didn't happen, interest rates would have been higher and savers would have made $500 billion more in interest over the past decade.
Mike Mayo is a bank analyst with Wells Fargo Securities. He's talking there specifically about interest on deposits, which would have been higher if not for low rates.
Those very low interest rates created a wealth transfer from the prudent savers to the more aggressive borrowers or risk takers.
And low rates also affected people who thought they were being safe investors by relying on payouts from bonds.
Many of the people who were investing in very safe investments were retirees.
That's Joe Minerick with the Committee for Economic Development. On the other hand, of course, a lot of savers are also borrowers who benefit from low rates.
A lot of people have mortgages, you know, even retirees, they still have money outstanding on a mortgage. And in many cases, people would take advantage of this to refinance their mortgage.
Dean Baker is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and he says research shows most people with a decent amount of savings didn't just keep it in their bank accounts. They invested it elsewhere.
Longer-term bonds, which have gone up in price because of low interest rates, and or stocks, which also were helped by low interest rates.
So low interest rates have certainly also helped a lot of people, which, of course, was the point of low interest rates to begin with. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, let's see what else happened today you ought to know about. The big bank CEOs were on Capitol Hill. There were some too big to fail, some other financial crisis callbacks. Most notable, though, was that this was the first time all those Wall Street banks had been at that long witness table together since February of 2009. Also, from the Treasury Department, this item, the Treasury predicts a $1.1 trillion deficit for fiscal year 2019. That's the one we're in. That's according to the latest Treasury statement released today. Just for some context here, in fiscal year 2017, so plus or minus 2 years ago, deficit was $665 billion. That's a B. On Wall Street this Wednesday, a little sound, not too much fury, signified, yeah, I don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The year of the Decacorn IPO continues, Decacorn being a company valued at more than $10 billion. Also, I guess, a horse with 10 horns, unicorn, a billion-dollar company, Decacorn, get it? Anyway, Uber is it. The ride-sharing company that waxes and wanes in public popularity is set to register for its initial public offering tomorrow, says the Wall Street Journal. $10 billion in shares going to the market, putting the valuation of that company at about $100 billion. Sounds like a lot, and it is, and Uber is expected to be the biggest IPO this year, among the biggest ever. But this number is about $20 billion below what everybody was thinking Uber was going to be valued at. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino sorts out how companies like Uber come up with these figures and why they might be putting on the brakes.
In the old days, a company's value was usually based on something pretty straightforward: profits. But in today's world of fast-growing but unprofitable tech startups, that benchmark is out the window.
I don't really think there is any known standard of valuing companies that go public.
Brian Hamilton is a co-founder of SageWorks Financial Analysis. He says in lieu of profits, investors look at factors like market size, user numbers, and sales growth to gauge valuation. But demand for shares is often driven by something much more intangible, says Barrett Daniels, an IPO advisor at Deloitte & Touche.
Truthfully, it's going to come down to the company's vision and how believable it is.
At an event in February, Uber's head of transportation policy, Andrew Salzberg, articulated that vision to Marketplace.
I think the growth story is, look, we think we can build something through an app that provides a better service than one of the most successful modes of transport that's ever been around, which is the personal car.
It's a vision that likely resonates with the approximately 100 million Uber users worldwide, but it's pretty similar to one that has already been tested in the public market by its competitor Lyft, which started offering shares a little more than a week ago.
It did not go well, that IPO, and I think there's a little lesson to be learned in that.
Kathleen Smith is a co-founder of Renaissance Capital. She says Lyft's falling share prices, which are now trading below their IPO price, show public investors may be feeling restrained.
I don't think this is a bad place that where we are with these big companies coming public, especially when the public market is being very discerning about price.
Smith says Lyft's experience can provide a roadmap to Uber and other companies to take a more conservative path in their valuations. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Let us now take a detour to the visual, to the screens, the three screens that dominate our lives, our phones, our computers, and our televisions. And to add to that list, we will add the screen on your car's dashboard. Tim Higgins wrote about the battle for that fourth screen and the billions of dollars at stake for the Wall Street Journal. Tim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I don't want to steal the lead here, but this is kind of a data play, right?
Absolutely. A decade ago, smartphone makers found themselves in a very similar situation as car makers today. And so car makers now are facing this similar battle. And we're seeing kind of two ways that they're addressing it. Either they're saying, hey, we can create our own digital ecosystem, or we better just go with Google and put their operating system in our dashboard.
Right. Before we get to the complexities of this thing, right, because it's a bit more complicated than just pulling out your phone out of your pocket and looking at it. How big is the market? What are we talking about on the upside for this?
This is a billions and billions of dollars of potential new revenue.
Yeah.
And as we see software become more and more involved in the car and that kind of digital life going in there, there's potential for a lot of new use cases out there, whether we go down the road with autonomous vehicles or just even with human-driven vehicles, there's potential to unlock new ways of making money and spending money.
All right, so let's look at some of these challenges here. The first of which is you're driving down the road at 70 miles an hour, and let's stick with human-driven cars here for the moment because we're not quite in autonomous vehicle land, but you're driving down the road at 70 miles an hour. It can be challenging to change a radio station, let alone pull up navigation or three menu levels deep and any of that stuff.
That's been the knock against these dashboards for several years now. People are frustrated with it. A lot of them, when you talk to them, will say, well, why isn't my dashboard as good as my phone? And there are several reasons for that. It's not a fair comparison. In the car, the designers of that system have a lot of things they have to worry about. They don't want the driver to be distracted while driving, so they're calculating that in and how they design it. And the other thing is the cost, and they just don't have the capabilities as the phone in your pocket.
Right. Challenge number two for some of these car companies, though, is that, and you alluded to this a little bit, they're fighting against Silicon Valley, and some car makers have chosen to go in-house, and others are doing battle, as it were, with Google and the rest of them.
It comes down to, for some car companies, a belief that they can evolve and develop more software capabilities. And some are saying, well, you know, can we really compete against Silicon Valley and its software prowess? Yeah. And they look at what Google is doing and say, we should just partner with them and turn over this operating system to Google and work with them. We can brand it so it looks like the car company that we are, but in the back end, not have to worry about the programming efforts.
Yeah. And then, of course, finally, once we get to autonomous vehicles, all of this becomes a little bit moot, right?
Well, car companies think this is actually one of the reasons why they need to pay attention to is because as cars become more electrified and perhaps less involved with the actual art of driving, the touch point for the customer might be that screen. And so they want that customer's digital life in their ecosystem.
Hmm. Tim Higgins covers technology and cars, in this case, for the Wall Street Journal. We got him in San Francisco. Tim, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up,
sometimes I ask my staff, I say, when did projects start costing so much?
Same here, pal. Same here. But first, I don't have a staff. But first, let's do the numbers. Down, I threw everybody off. Dow Industrials gained 6 points today, less than a 10%, 26,157. The NASDAQ up 54 points, 0.7%, 79.64. The S&P 500 rose 10 points, about 0.3%, 28.88. Levi Strauss, which you might recall went public not too long ago, rose 4% after a strong earnings report. Other clothing retailers also up. Guess up 2.3%. Gap closed higher by nearly 1%. Ralph Lauren ticked up 0.4%. That despite drop in power prices that Mitchell Hartman was talking about. On Wall Street, banks had a fine day, thank you very much, despite that hearing. J.P. Morgan up 0.4%. Citigroup tacked on about 0.5%. Delta Airlines raised its forecast today. Stock followed suit, gained 1.5%. Boeing, ticker symbol BA, just because they're in the news, down 1.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Maybe you hadn't heard, I don't know, but season 8 and last of Game of Thrones starts this Sunday on HBO. The show has made millions for HBO, billions, maybe you don't know. It's changed the lives of the actors who've starred in it, and it has launched the Hollywood career of a language creator named David Peterson. Peterson won the contest back in 2009 to create a fictional Dothraki language. Since then, he has created languages for a CW show called The 100, the Netflix movie Bright, and a second language for Game of Thrones called High Valyrian, which makes him pretty much the go-to language guy in Hollywood right now. We talked to him at his home down in Orange County, California.
I started creating my very own language in my first linguistics class. If you want to create languages, linguistics helps, but it's not all you're going to need. Language creation is an art form, and linguistics is a science. You can learn the principles behind it, but that will really only teach you to create a functional language, not a good one. If you're going the route of a spoken language, which is most of the languages that I'm called on to create, basically the language breaks down into different parts. There is the phonology, that is, the sounds of the language, what sounds are going to count for meaning changes or meaning distinctions. Then there is the morphology, that is, the inflection of nouns and the inflection of verbs. Are nouns going to show case? Is there going to be gender in the language? Is it going to have tense, aspect, modality, which ones? Are there going to be prefixes, suffixes, internal changes? How are you going to ask questions like yes-no questions or WH questions? What's the number system going to be? All of that stuff. And then you get to spend the rest of your entire life creating words. I can spend the rest of my life creating words for Dothraki and never reach the level of English vocabulary. So it's a life sentence. It's a fun one, but it's a life sentence if you want to take it seriously. When I was creating both Dothraki and High Valyrian, there were little bits of language that George R. R. Martin had included in his books. A few for Dothraki, including a couple of full phrases, and then really just two for High Valyrian, just the phrases Valar Morhulis and Valar Dohaeris, and then like a stray word here or there. My job was to take everything that George R. R. Martin had created and use that as my starting point, building off of it after that to make sure that everything that I created fit with his original vision and to make sure that everything that was in the book still counted as grammatical once I was done. Most of the time, the actors on all the various shows and films I work on get the pronunciation and the delivery of their lines pretty good. Sometimes it's excellent, which is great. And then every so often it's absolutely abysmal and I just roll my eyes. But it's like, that's showbiz. You just kind of have to roll with it.
We had David Peterson teach us how to say this is Marketplace in both Dothraki and High Valyrian. Don't know if he puts that pause and emphasis in there, though. If you're in that Venn diagram overlap of Marketplace and Game of Thrones fans, you can find out how on our Instagram, Marketplace, APM. With the sidelong observation that we're still waiting for the Trump administration's infrastructure week to happen, the fact of the matter is that we need a whole lot of infrastructure spending in this economy. Maybe just not the kind of spending that is happening right now. Take, just for instance, a new subway here. Digging train tunnels ain't cheap anywhere in the world, but it's exceptionally expensive in the United States. Rail construction costs are routinely higher than the costs in other countries. Even the cheapest underground project here most recently, Seattle's U-Link, cost $600 million a mile, double by one measure, the foreign average. How come, you ask? Marketplace's Ben Bradford hit the streets of L.A. to find out.
Los Angeles is sprinting to build miles of new subway lines before the traffic-choked city hosts the 2028 Summer Olympics. On the corner of Wilshire and La Brea, dump trucks line up at an excavator, which heaps dirt into them from the tunnel 90 feet below. The four-year-old cites a staging area for the first leg of new subway, set to open in 2023. LA Metro's Rick Clark describes an intricate dance keeping the nine-mile project on track.
The dump trucks are as important to the project schedule as the tunnel boring machine.
Despite the precision, this extension costs $1 billion a mile, three times the norm in other countries. I asked Clark why.
That's a good question, because sometimes I ask my staff, I say, when did projects start costing so much?
LA's not alone. Rail projects of all types around the U.S. routinely cost two, three, or even 10 times their European counterparts. There are some commonly cited reasons about why it's so expensive.
You might think of land costs being higher, construction costs being higher, or the complexity of project design. You might think of labor costs and regulations.
Tracy Gordon at the Tax Policy Center says the problem with those reasons is that other countries contend with these factors too.
What's interesting is how you can come up with a counterexample for almost every explanation.
So I called transit researcher Alain Levy in Germany, who's studying the difference in international costs. He believes the explanations for increased rail expenses in the U.S. are really just excuses. For example, when American cities cite union contracts and wages for making rail so expensive,
100% excuse. In the Nordic countries, where the majority of the labor force is unionized, the costs are pretty low. In Texas, you know, a right-to-work state, costs are basically the same as in, let's say, Massachusetts.
Sometimes people blame strong property rights for making it difficult for U.S. subway projects to acquire land.
It's an excuse. In Japan and in France, if the landowners aren't happy, they riot. In the United States, best they can do is ask for a little bit more money.
What about the density of our cities? All those people, more stuff to dodge underground. Doesn't that drive up our cost compared to other countries?
It's an excuse. It's the exact opposite. Usually American cities are less dense, so you would expect costs there to be lower.
All right, so if those are all excuses, what could be the legitimate reasons for our billion-dollar subways? The transit experts I spoke with have suspicions. The tangle of local, state, and federal agencies involved in any given project may create excessive bureaucracy. It may also be easier here for a single local official to impede a project or change its course if even a few vocal constituents object, all of which could add uniquely American costs. Levy says they don't know.
It's the sort of thing we need to study more.
Okay, but how can it be that we don't know the answer to this very basic and expensive question? Levy thinks that's actually pretty simple.
In the United States, they never look at best industry practices outside the U.S. It's kind of jarring.
For instance, other countries generally build smaller subway stations where riders walk down directly to the track level. But U.S. subways almost always include huge multi-level stations with mezzanines. LA Metro brought in an outside consultant to make cost control recommendations based on eight other transit agencies. Only one was outside the U.S., in London. Metro's Clark says he's up for a trip abroad.
Personally, I'd like to have my boss send me to Spain and France and Germany to find out how they're doing it. And actually, it would be a good, valuable thing.
Because as long as we expect to pay a premium over the rest of the world, our transit dollars won't take us all that far. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that April is National Financial Literacy Month. I saw this at MarketWatch, by the way, to give credit where credit is due. The most asked how to save for question that Americans asked Google last year. What do you think? Any guesses? How to save for a house, retirement, car, college, and wedding. Round out the top five. All right, we got to go. Dow up 6 points today, less than a 10%. NASDAQ up 54 points, about 0.7%. The S&P 500 rose 10 points, 0.3%. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Jake Gorski, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.